therapist in New Orleans, where she'd moved in with a tattoo artist named Fred, spelled with a PH. When Eli proposed joint custody, he heard his soon-to-be ex-wife sigh from over 1,000 miles away. "Ruby can spend time in the summers with me," Annette finally said. "But Eli, let's be honest, you were the one who wanted kids, not me." Eli opened his mouth, ready to ask Annette what was wrong with her, how it was possible for her not to love the baby they'd made together, how anyone could not want Ruby. Then he closed it. Annette wouldn't have any answers, at least not answers that would satisfy him. "I'll never understand you," he let himself say. And again, he heard Annette sighing. "I know," she said, and ended the call. For the next 7 years, except for 1 month a summer, it was just Eli and Ruby in a one-bedroom apartment financed at first by his parents on the Upper West Side. When Eli started working, he could handle the expense, plus private school for Ruby. Eli might have failed at marriage, but he was determined not to fail at fatherhood. He arranged his schedule so that he could be home for as many of Ruby's waking hours as possible. His mom came to the city twice a week, and he'd found a wonderful nanny to stay with Ruby when neither of them could do it. He mastered a variety of hairstyles and kid-friendly meals. He hosted playdates and sleepovers. He never missed a single choir concert or parent-teacher conference. At every school play or class picnic or non-denominational holiday assembly, Eli was there, camera in hand, cheering for his girl. Ruby had been 7 years old when she decided that she wanted to learn to play the drums. Eli had enrolled her in music school, and that was where they'd met Sarah. He'd seen her while he waited for Ruby, a woman of medium height and build, with shoulder-length dark blonde hair, a woman who walked fast and had a determined jut to her chin. She wore crisp blouses and creased pants or colorful print dresses and high-heeled boots. The kids called her Miss Sarah, and all of them adored her. She seemed calm and good-humored, utterly unflappable, whether she was dealing with a parent unhappy about how quickly her kid was progressing or a preschooler who'd thrown up in the middle of drum circle. He'd planned to do nothing more than admire Sarah Weinberg from afar, especially because he sensed that bringing a new woman into Ruby's life would be disruptive. By the end of her first month in second grade, he'd been called to the school twice because Ruby's teachers had overheard her making up wild stories to explain her mother's absence. "I have to give her points for creativity, but the trouble with telling the other kids that her mother was a lion tamer who was eaten by one of her lions is that now they think it'll happen to their moms too," said Mrs. Levinson. Eli promised he'd have a talk with Ruby, which had been just as excruciating as he'd known it would be. "Honey, you know your mom isn't in the circus," he'd said gently. And Ruby, her face twisted, her eyes full of tears, had said, "Why won't she come back?" And what answer could Eli give her? Eli did what he could to make up for Annette's absence. And Ruby was a generally good-humored girl. But sometimes she got quiet, her mood turning mournful. At her birthday parties and around Hanukkah, he'd catch his daughter looking at the door, like she was hoping Annette would come through it, arms full of presents, heart full of regret. "That woman really did a number on poor Ruby," said his mother, who'd refused to so much as speak Annette's name once Annette had gone and referred to Eli's ex-wife only as "that woman." Eli was loath to start a new relationship because introducing a new person would be difficult, and having another woman leave would be even worse. His daughter had already been abandoned by the most important woman in her life. He wasn't going to risk letting it happen again. He wouldn't complicate things for Ruby for the sake of his own happiness. As far as he was concerned, parents forfeited their rights to make their own pleasure a priority as soon as a baby arrived. Annette, of course, would still probably be putting herself first when she was 70 years old, even if she'd had a dozen kids by then. but Ruby had taken matters into her own hands. "Miss Sarah, do you like grilled cheese?" she'd asked in her most winsome voice after determining that Miss Sarah was single. "I do," Sarah had answered with a smile. "It's one of my very favorite sandwiches." "My dad makes the very best grilled cheese in the world," Ruby said. "I think you should come to our house so he can make us grilled cheese." Sarah and Eli had looked at each other. Then Eli had smiled, and Sarah had shrugged. And somehow, she'd ended up walking 6 blocks to their apartment where Eli had, indeed, made her a grilled cheese. "With sweet pickle slices on the side," Ruby insisted. Sarah offered to take him out for coffee during Ruby's next lessons, and those coffees became a regular fixture of his Tuesday afternoons. After the 4th one, Sarah asked if he wanted to get dinner. Regretfully, Eli had explained the situation, stumbling through what sounded even to his ears like an excuse, concluding with, "If I was going to date anyone, it would absolutely be you." Sarah had listened to this recitation with her face expressionless before sitting back, her eyes narrowed and her arms crossed over her chest. "So you're not going to date until Ruby's, what, in college? In 10 years? Eli didn't answer because he couldn't imagine Ruby being in college or Ruby growing up and leaving him. Then again, he'd never been able to picture Annette walking out on a baby, and she had, which showed the limits of his imagination. Ruby would leave someday, and then where would he be? Almost 50, still alone. "I like you," Sarah said. "I like that you're so concerned about Ruby's happiness, and I definitely don't want to do anything to hurt her. But I know there are single parents who date, and the kids manage to get through it. And it's just dinner," she said with a smile. "We're not pledging our lives to each other or anything." She looked at him, her heart-shaped face open and expectant. "We could try, if you want to." He decided that he did. Right away, Eli had seen a future with Sarah. Even though she was 12 years younger than he was, Sarah was an old soul, grounded and practical and unusually mature, ready to start a family and buy a home. She was also, it emerged, financially equipped to do so in a way few of her contemporaries or his were, although Eli didn't find that out until after he'd proposed and Sarah had consented and then, a little shyly, asked if he would be okay with a prenup. "Sure," he'd said. Then belatedly, "Why?" That was when he found out that Sarah's mother wasn't just an English professor. She'd been a best-selling novelist who'd had a book turned into a movie and then a miniseries back in the 1980s. She made some money, and she did well with her investments. She put me and my brother through college and gave us each some money when we turned 25. Eli was glad he hadn't known about that until after he'd proposed, because he had to admit, in his most private thoughts, that the money made the woman he loved even more appealing. The idea of having Sarah in his life and in Ruby's and being able to buy a beautiful home in a good neighborhood and also not having to worry about college tuition, it seemed like the universe was making up for his disastrous first marriage by handing him a near-perfect second chance. Still, he'd promised himself that if Ruby disliked Sarah, that if the three of them couldn't get along, he would end it. Ruby hadn't asked to be the child of divorced parents, bouncing between New York City during the school year and a few weeks in New Orleans or Antigua or wherever Annette had landed in the summer. Eli was determined to keep the promise he'd made to himself that he'd never do anything to make his daughter's life harder. At first, Ruby had been delighted when Miss Sarah the music lady showed up at her house or picked her up after school or spent time with her in the park. When Sarah's presence went from being a novelty to a constant, when Sarah went from being a friend to someone who took away some of Eli's attention and reminded Ruby to clear her plate and clean her room, Ruby was far less enamored. Sarah, to her credit, hadn't been offended when Ruby had acted out. She never got angry when Ruby would ask, "When are you going back home?" Or when, at breakfast on the weekends, Ruby asked her father to take her to the diner, just the two of them, because Sarah's scrambled eggs tasted funny. "She's gotten used to having you all to herself," Sarah said when Eli apologized for Ruby's behavior. "If I were her, I wouldn't want to share you either." Sarah seemed to know, intuitively, just when to go meet friends for a movie or return to her own apartment to give them a few hours or a few days. She gave Ruby space and let Eli handle the discipline. She tried hard not to try too hard, giving Ruby enough room to come to her. And eventually, Ruby had. It helped that Annette was so inconstant. Her flakiness compared poorly to Sarah's dependability. The way Sarah was always there, quietly standing by, ready to help when Ruby would let her. It also probably hadn't hurt that Sarah's parents, Lee and Veronica, adored Ruby. They would buy her toys and piles of books, and Ronnie would let her take whatever she wanted from Ronnie's extensive collection of costume jewelry when they visited them. Ronnie and Lee would host them in Boston or on the Cape and plan special outings for Ruby. Broadway shows, museum visits, a trip to a fancy hotel for tea. When Sarah brought Eli and Ruby to their summer place on the Cape, Ronnie had taken Ruby on hikes through the dunes to the cranberry bogs and taught her how to use a clam rake to retrieve shellfish from the bay. Ronnie had been the one to teach Ruby how to ride a bike and sail a sunfish, how to do a racing dive and a flip turn in the pool. Ruby and Ronnie would swim across ponds together, both of them in navy blue tank-style suits, Ronnie with a bright orange personal flotation device looped around her waist. They would ride their bikes into Provincetown for ice cream cones and sit on the Provincetown Library lawn to watch the Portuguese festival and the carnival parade. "All the stuff she used to do with me and my brother when we were kids," Sarah said. Ronnie and Lee had helped. The Cape itself had helped. The house they'd eventually purchased had too. Eli and Sarah and Ruby spent 3 months of weekends house hunting, looking for a place that they could all share. Eventually, they'd found a slightly dilapidated brownstone that had been owned by just one family for the last 80 years. "It's like a castle," Ruby said when she'd first glimpsed the place from the sidewalk. Eli supposed that after life in an apartment, a 4-story house might indeed look that way to a little girl. While Sarah stood in the kitchen, quizzing the contractor about the HVAC and the pipes, a conversation she'd spent the previous night prepping for with a book called Home Heating and Cooling for Dummies, Ruby had walked slowly up the staircase, stopping on each floor and counting the number of rooms out loud. When she got to the attic, Eli had been right behind her. He'd watched as she'd stopped, mouth agape. Her favorite book at the moment was A Little Princess. Eli didn't doubt that, in her head, Ruby had assigned poor Sarah the role of cruel Miss Minchin, who banishes the orphan Sarah crew to the attic. Ruby had looked, then gone racing down the stairs to find Sarah and tow her up to the attic, pulling her by the hand.
"Please, please, can we buy this house? And can this please be my bedroom?" she'd asked.
Sarah pretended to think about it. "Really? You want to be all the way up here by yourself? Are you sure?"
"Yes, please, I'm sure. It's so, so perfect."
"Okay, but only if you promise you'll help me pick out the wallpaper."
"I promise, I promise,"
Ruby had yelped, and she'd thrown her arms around Sarah's midriff, almost tackling her to the ground. Eli and Sarah had gotten married 6 months later. By then, they were coasting on the fumes of the last of Ruby's initial goodwill and her excitement about the new house. The hard years were coming, but back then, Ruby had been thrilled about the wedding, insisting on writing vows, welcoming Sarah into the family, and giving Sarah a special necklace that she and Eli picked out, a gift just from her. When Sarah had promised before the rabbi and God and all their guests to love them both for as long as she lived, most of the guests and both Eli's mother and Sarah's were crying. For years, Ruby had reigned as queen of the attic. Eli and Sarah got used to the sound of Ruby's little feet stomping up those stairs, the door closing at a volume just short of a slam. Then Dexter arrived, and then Miles. Ruby had loved her brothers and had finally let Sarah love her. And Eli was happy, happier than he'd ever hoped he'd be after Annette had left him. He had a circle of friends, hobbies he enjoyed. He cycled with a local club, played squash once a week, brewed his own beer in the basement. He was grateful for his good fortune, for his marriage, his beautiful family, his second chance, and he'd taken care to behave in a way that showed that gratitude. He'd been kind to his patients and generous with his colleagues, to the students he taught and to the people he employed. He gave money to charity. He supported diversity initiatives and Black Lives Matter and the women who spoke out when #MeToo became a thing. He added his pronouns to his online biography and refused to speak at seminars or on panels to which only straight white men had been invited. He called his parents every week and visited them every month. When his brother, Ari, at 54, still the family fuck-up, forgot their parents' birthdays or anniversaries, Eli added his name to the card or the gift that he, Eli, had purchased and lied when their mother asked. "Oh yeah, Ari helped me pick it out. He knows orchids are your favorite." When Ruby came home with friends, Eli would ask what pronouns they used. He did his best to be respectful and apologized when he got it wrong. He tried to move through the world gently, to follow the Hippocratic oath, do no harm. For his entire life, Eli Danhauser had been good, except for 4 days, more than 20 years ago, when Eli had not been good, when he'd been the exact opposite of good. And now, he feared, the result of that single brief lapse had come back to haunt him, the way he always knew it would. And the truth, instead of setting anyone free, was going to destroy everything he'd worked for and hurt everyone he'd loved. Ronnie. Veronica Levy hung her towel and her cover-up, one of Lee's old button-down shirts, on the knobby branch of a scrub pine. She kicked off her Crocs and stood, looking out at the pond, its water the gray of a tarnished nickel in the early morning light. Wisps of steam rose from the surface and dissolved into the air. The water would be cold, but there was no better feeling than the handful of seconds after that first wincing shock, when she'd force her arms to paddle and her feet to kick, and she would feel her heart start beating again, her skin tingling, her body absolutely, irrefutably alive. Ronnie clipped an inflatable float on a belt around her waist and made her way down to the water. Once the belt hadn't had quite so far to travel, and her legs hadn't been quite so jiggly, or her skin so fine and slack. Once she'd been deliciously curvy, even though she'd wasted years despairing of her body, trying to wish and diet and jazzercise the weight away, starving off the same 10 or 15 pounds that always came back, usually with friends. She'd been pretty back then, her skin smooth, hair shiny, eyes bright. These days, everything was dulled and faded, and every part of her body from her breasts on down had developed an unseemly droop. In clothes or even in a swimsuit, she could still look not terrible. Out of clothes, well, out of clothes she just tried not to look. She tried to be grateful for everything that her body could still do, that she could still drive and carry her own groceries, that she could walk, that she could swim, that she was still here at all. Veronica waded out until the water lapped her thighs, then took a deep breath, braced herself, and submerged, ducking down, shuddering as the water rose over her shoulders, her neck, her face, sending her hair drifting in a cloud around her head. She rose to the surface, gasping, wiped water from her eyes, and set off across the pond, her arms lifting and falling smoothly, legs flutter-kicking, the flotation device trailing on its rope behind her. She was not as fast as she'd once been, but she could still make it across the pond and back again in under an hour. This early in the morning, this early in the season, there were no other swimmers, just Veronica, and the schools of darting silvery minnows, the croaking frogs and the tadpoles, the sunfish and the snapping turtles who hadn't yet emerged to take their place on the sun-warmed rocks. Veronica stroked smoothly through the water, feeling it lapping at her shoulders, cupping her body and bearing her up like a strong hand in a silken glove. When she'd made it across the pond, she slowed her pace, dog paddling into the reeds, peering around to see if the pond people, the families who owned the cabins and camps in the woods, had put up new signs yet. Yes, there they were, 3 ankle-high admonishments painted on planks of scrap wood, hammered into crosses with the words, "No trespassing" in blaze orange, jutting out of the soft sand. Ronnie swam closer, treading water, trying to be quiet. She could see an older woman, in other words, a woman about her age, standing on the shore, observing her. The other woman wore a linen caftan in faded pink, with an oversized sun hat on her head. Her feet were bare, her legs were deeply tanned, with varicose veins twisting over her calves and up her thighs. She was probably naked underneath that caftan. The pond people were avid skinny dippers. Veronica used to tell her husband that it was weaponized nudity, another way for them to claim the pond as their own. Which it wasn't. People on the Cape could own land right up to the shoreline. They could not own the water, either salt or brackish or fresh. Not the ocean, not the bay, not the marshes, and not the ponds. This fact did not prevent the pond people from scowling or shouting at any swimmer who dared come too close to shore.
"Get off our property,"
she remembered a little boy yelling at her and at Sam and Sarah when they'd made the swim one summer. Stalwart Sarah had glared right back at him. "Make me," she'd muttered under her breath. While Sarah was giving the boy her most scorching stink eye, Sam, her sensitive soul, had turned and started swimming back. He'd spent the rest of the morning brooding on the shore. "Why are they so mean?" he'd asked on the bayside beach later that day. "We weren't even on their property." "Because they're assholes," Lee had said succinctly, and winked at his son as Veronica frowned and said, "Language." "They are, though," her husband said, opening a new section of the New York Times. "They're jerks," she'd said primly, and told Sam that he hadn't done anything wrong. Ronnie had her own ideas about why the pond people were so possessive of the shoreline, and why they reflexively despised people like the Levy Weinbergs. Once upon a time, she imagined telling her son, the entire Cape was theirs. The entire world, she could hear her husband thinking, his good-natured face wearing an unusually cynical expression. Back then, Jews weren't allowed to buy houses in their neighborhoods. They started beach clubs and neighborhood associations just to keep people like us out. But we worked hard, we became successful, and some of us did well enough to buy our own homes in the handful of towns that would have us. Maybe some of the people who live near the pond are unhappy about that. Maybe they wish the whole world still belonged to them alone. Veronica had never set foot in a pond person's home, but one of her friends had. "It was unbelievable," Dolores had reported to the other members of the book club that met at the Truro Library. "There's one building with a kitchen, a living room, 4 teeny tiny cabins that hardly look big enough for a bed, and 1 toilet for everyone." Her eyes had gleamed as she'd shared all the details. "Everything was held together with duct tape. Literal duct tape. And they had barrels of booze and no food. Nothing to eat except a sleeve of Ritz crackers and supermarket cheddar." She'd sniffed. "Not my idea of entertaining." Veronica had murmured something about the expense of keeping a place on the Outer Cape in good repair. How, between the damage the salt air could do and the paucity of trustworthy available contractors, everything was more expensive and time-consuming than it would be on the mainland. "And it sounds like it's very eco-friendly," she'd added. Oh, it sounds just like my husband's family's place in Maine, said Trudy, one of the other members. Towels so thin you can see through them. Sheets that are 70 years old. One bathroom and a 6-bedroom house. It's their idea of fun, she'd said. I think it takes them back to summer camp or something. She'd had them all laughing with stories of her stay in Maine as a young bride, how she'd driven 20 minutes to the nearest town each morning to use a gas station restroom after she'd caused her in-law's single toilet to flood her first night there. Of course, back then, there'd been a way to tell who was playing at poverty and who was genuinely broke. The local paper had published a biannual list of property owners who'd fallen behind on their taxes. Everyone in town had condemned the practice. Everyone had also read the lists the second they were published. But the paper had been purchased by new owners. These days, Ronnie wasn't sure which of the pond people were like Trudy's in-laws and which of them actually, genuinely, didn't have enough money for the upkeep of a summer home. All she knew for sure was that the pond people all seemed to be fanatics about keeping everyone from the public beach away from their shores, and that once, years ago, one of their children, son of the pond people, had hurt her daughter. In the water, Veronica kicked and stroked until she could make out the pursed-lipped expression on the woman's face. "Good morning," she called, and gave a cheery wave. "Beautiful day, isn't it?" The woman's lips tightened. Without a word, she turned and walked back to the cabin, mostly hidden by the reeds. Ronnie saw faded, peeling paint, the ripped screen of the door, the old chintz cushions of the daybed on the porch. She could hear the screech of unoiled hinges as the door creaked shut. Ronnie sighed, submerged, and started the return trip. Back to the shore, back to her car, back to her house, which had central air and bathrooms in multiples. Flashy, showy, nouveau riche, they'd say, these people with Mayflower pedigrees and first names that were indistinguishable from last names. 40 years after she and Lee had bought their house, they were still newcomers. 40 years meant nothing to people whose ancestors had arrived in America when Ronnie's had still been in the shtetls, picking potatoes and running from the Cossacks. 40 years might not mean much, but Ronnie still felt, would always feel, that the Outer Cape was her place. She hated to think of leaving the house that she had loved so much and for so long. The house where she'd lived for the last 10 years, after she and Lee had sold their place in Cambridge and become year-rounders. When the kids were little, they'd added on a guest house, dreaming of summers surrounded by their children and eventually their grandchildren. She wanted her grandkids to have the kinds of summers she'd been able to give to her twins. Days spent on the beach or the bike paths, eating lobster rolls and ice cream cones, and going to the Wellfleet drive-in. But after years of dreaming and invitations and increasingly pointed hints, she had to acknowledge the reality. Sam lived all the way on the other side of the country, so he and his stepson couldn't visit often, even if they'd wanted to. Sarah was close enough, but she had decidedly different opinions about summer than her mother. At 8, Dexter was already studying Mandarin and judo and the violin. Miles, at nearly 7, played on 2 soccer teams and had just started to learn ASL. It was his idea, Sarah said, sounding defensive when Ronnie had asked. Their school days were scheduled from morning until night. Their summers were even worse. The boys came to the Cape for a week in June, right after school ended, before their camps began, and much of that week was occupied by mandatory practice of their respective instruments and sports. Ronnie had felt like a teenager trying to avoid Mom's censorious eyes when she'd sneak the boys out of the house for a walk on the beach to look for shells, or for a quick bike ride. It was ridiculous, but Ronnie knew better than to say so. Sarah was sensitive to criticism, quick to unfold her tales of woe about how abandoned she'd felt as a little girl when Veronica was working. You were always fobbing us off on the mother's helpers, Sarah would say. You were always busy. That did not comport with Veronica's memories of the kind of parent she'd been. Yes, there had been mother's helpers, but she'd stopped publishing when the kids were young. She'd been a full-time academic, which meant she had plenty of work in the summer months, but at least it was work that was portable, work that let her stay with them on the Cape. She remembered spending every summer day with the twins, the mornings of swimming lessons at Gull Pond, the afternoons on the beaches, Cornhill or Longnook or Head of the Meadow. True, Veronica had needed a few hours a day to grade papers or talk to the graduate students she advised, to plan her lessons and read for pleasure. True, there'd always been a mother's helper, an extra set of hands to help with the showers and the meals and the bedtime routines. But she remembered being an attentive, hands-on, present mother who'd taught her kids to swim and ride their bikes and then gave them the gift of empty hours to fill with books or swims or walks or frisbee games with friends, and was telling a kid to amuse herself in a beautiful house right on the ocean really so awful? Poor you, Veronica would think, but never say, when Sarah got going on her lonely childhood and her neglectful mom. Of all the kids, it was Ruby, her bonus grandchild, with whom Ronnie had gotten to spend the kind of summers she'd dreamed about. Eli had recognized the Cape, and Ronnie and Lee, as a refuge for his prickly little girl. "Between you and me, she's giving Sarah a hard time," he'd confided to Ronnie late one night. This was before he and Sarah had gotten married, when the three of them had come to the Cape for a long weekend. Ronnie saw her opportunity. She'd begged and pleaded and finally convinced Eli to let Ruby stay. "Are you sure you've got time for this?" he'd asked. "We'll enroll her in camp so you don't have to entertain her all day." "I would be happy to entertain her all day," Ronnie had said. The next morning, she and Ruby had waved goodbye to Eli and Sarah from the half-moon-shaped deck off the kitchen, where Ronnie grew sage and mint and basil and rosemary. Ruby plucked a leaf of mint. She'd sniffed it, and then she'd peered up at Veronica, her face solemn, the breeze ruffling her curls. "What are we going to do?" "We could go for a walk and look for box turtles and horseshoe crabs," Ronnie proposed. "Or we could kayak through the marsh." Ruby chose the walk. They kayaked the next day. The day after that, they rode the bike path to get an ice cream cone in Eastham. And on the rainy day that followed, they went to Wellfleet for a matinee and completed a 500-piece puzzle at the kitchen table. Ronnie taught Ruby how to play gin. Ruby taught Ronnie how to play bananagrams. When it was dinner time, they'd grill hot dogs and hamburgers. Some nights, they'd just eat freshly buttered corn and sliced tomatoes from the farm stand up the road. And when Lee arrived on Friday nights, they'd make challah for a special Shabbat welcome home dinner. Ruby was good company, a little solemn and almost frighteningly competitive. "You aren't letting me win, are you?" she'd asked, eyes narrowed, after Ronnie had praised her lavishly for playing a Z on a triple word score space, and Lee had to assure Ruby that his wife never let anyone win at Scrabble. Ruby was focused and determined, but also funny, and usually cheerful, and willing to try new things. Best of all, she loved the water the way Ronnie did. The first time she and Ruby had swum across the pond together, Lee told her that he'd never seen Ruby looking as delighted as she had when they'd emerged from the water and gone running to him, saying, "I made it the whole way across without stopping." That night in bed, he'd brought up the idea of getting a place in New York City. "A pied-à-terre," he'd said, rolling the words with a flourish. "Why not? You'll be able to see Ruby all year round, and Sarah's going to want you close if she has babies." Regretfully, Ronnie had told him no. She'd reminded Lee that he had no plans to retire in the near future, and that his firm was in Boston, that a place in Manhattan wasn't practical. She didn't mention her own reasons for avoiding New York. 2 weeks had sped by. When they were over, Ruby hadn't wanted to go. "Why can't I stay longer? Can I come back next summer? Can I stay longer next time?" Ronnie smiled, remembering as she swam until her thoughts drifted from her grandchildren to her children. She'd always believed the major crisis of Sarah's life had happened years ago, when Sarah had been 18 and had to decide whether to pursue a career as a pianist. Sarah had been in agony, struggling to make up her mind. One morning she'd say, "That's it, I'm done." And that afternoon she'd be back at the grand piano they'd bought when she was 12, playing the same bars of a Chopin nocturne or a moody Beethoven concerto over and over and over again. "I've worked so hard, I don't want to just quit on myself," she'd told Ronnie. And Ronnie hugged her, telling Sarah she'd support her no matter what she chose, never voicing her own secret wish that Sarah would stick with it, that she be recognized as one of the best young pianists in the world, rewarded with all the fame and glory, the accolades and the newspaper profiles, the applause of crowds and the admiration of strangers, a version of the world that Ronnie herself had walked away from before Sarah had even been born. Sarah had chosen the safer path. She'd gone off to Wellesley, glowing the way only a teenage girl who has for the first time been told "I love you" by someone who wasn't a relative could glow. Less than a week later, that boy had broken Sarah's heart. Ronnie, remembering, kicked at the water a little harder than was necessary, telling herself what she told herself then, that maybe that heartbreak had been a good thing, a distraction from Sarah's previous sorrow. Sarah had gotten over it eventually. She'd dated other boys, she'd moved to New York City, and eventually she'd met Eli. Ronnie had liked Eli, but she'd worried about Sarah trying to make a life with an older man, a man who'd already been married and had a daughter. She worried, too, that Sarah was throwing herself into marriage and motherhood and a ready-made family mostly because it was a prescribed path with clear landmarks and borders. And that's what she wanted after abandoning music, where her journey would have been just as regimented, the steps just as clear. The competitions and the recitals, the lessons and the master classes and the practice, practice, practice. Lee had been Eli's booster from the start. "He's old," Ronnie would say. "He's seasoned," Lee would reply. "And I think Sarah could be good for Ruby. They'll be good for each other." "She'll be happy," Lee had said. And he'd been right. At least, that's what Ronnie had always believed, although lately she'd been worried. When the stay-at-home orders came, Sarah said she loved having Ruby home again. She was glad that the boys were safe, and thank God they're old enough to not need me every second of the day, she'd added. And Ronnie had shuddered, thinking of the women trying to work remotely in a house or apartment with infants or toddlers or preschool-aged children who did need attention every waking moment, and with husbands who might not see helping out as part of their job. When Ronnie asked, Sarah would talk about how Eli seemed distant and distracted, which didn't sound like the son-in-law Ronnie knew. And when Ronnie didn't ask, Sarah didn't bring up her husband at all, which, more than anything Sarah did say, suggested trouble. And Sam, her baby, her darling, who'd finally fallen in love and gotten married only to lose his wife so quickly. His wife and his home, Ronnie thought as she kicked, kicked, kicked through the water, wondering if she'd need a second trip across the pond to calm down. How could God or fate or the world be so awful to Sam? Ronnie paused, treading water to catch her breath. When she set off again, she swam at a more sedate pace, reminding herself that the world was not a rancid bag of garbage. At least, it wasn't just that. There was happiness, too. Like Ruby's wedding. A simha, a happy occasion. A bittersweet one, too. The sign she'd been waiting for that it was time to let go of her dream house and all the hope she'd had for it. The summer palace, Lee had called it when he'd teased her. But they'd been happy there, the four of them. Then Ronnie and Lee had been happy there together, and they'd been happy with Ruby when she'd come to visit. Now it was just Ronnie, alone all the time, even though she imagined she could still hear her husband's voice, could still almost see him, out of the corner of her eye doing the crossword puzzle at the picnic table, or standing at the deck with his hands on the railing, admiring the sunset. She had to be realistic. The house might be her heart's true home, but it was far too big for just one person. The children and grandchildren she'd hoped would come and fill it weren't going to materialize. And the time would come when she wouldn't be able to manage the stairs, when she'd need her bedroom, bathroom, and kitchen all on the same level. At least, Ronnie thought, she would get her family together one last time, for one big party. A wedding. What could be happier than that? She'd take lots of pictures. She'd send her children and grandchildren home with happy and hopefully lasting memories. And then she'd tell Paul Norman, who'd sold her the place years ago, that she was ready to let some new family enjoy this beautiful place. Ronnie stroked through the water until it was shallow enough to stand. The sun was coming up, the water shading amber and gold, and she could catch flashes of the sandy bottom. Water weeds swayed in her wake. Minnows flickered around her feet as she climbed slowly back onto the shore and stood, wringing out her hair, letting the water drip from the skirt of her swimsuit to soak the sand at her feet. She dried off, got dressed, and drove slowly along the rutted dirt road until she could turn onto Route 6. At home, she spent her day puttering, planting new herbs in the kitchen garden, sorting through her books and collecting a bag of them to donate to the library. It had been close to 50 years since she'd published her last book, but her editor and eventually her editor's assistant continued to send her galleys of new novels. First, they'd hoped she'd offer an endorsement. Eventually, when so much time had passed that her name no longer meant anything, they'd just send her books they thought she'd like. Ronnie carried the bags out to the car. She'd moved on to the kitchen and was trying to unpick a mesh bag that had somehow gotten tangled in her garbage disposal. The glamorous life of a former best-selling author, she thought, when her phone buzzed on the counter. Veronica breathed in deeply, sent up a brief prayer for strength, and hit the answer button. "Hello, Suzanne." "Is this really happening?" her sister demanded. "Is Ruby actually getting married?" "It's actually happening," Ronnie confirmed. "But she's a baby," said Suzanne. "She's 22," said Ronnie. "How old was Mom when she got married? 19? "That was a different time," said Suzanne. "Is anyone going to try to talk some sense into her?" "She's in love," Ronnie said, keeping her voice mild. "And Ruby's always been stubborn. If someone tried to talk her out of it, do you think she'd listen?" "So Sarah and Eli are just letting this happen? You're just letting this happen? At your house, on your deck?" "Suzanne," Ronnie said patiently, "they're both of age. If we told them no, they'd elope. And then where would we be? They'd still be married, and we wouldn't even have the pleasure of a wedding." And oh, how Ronnie was longing for the pleasure of that wedding. Dexter and Miles and Sam's stepson, Connor, splashing in the pool, collecting hermit crabs on the beach. Sam and Sarah and Ruby in the kitchen with her, using Lee's recipe for linguine with clam sauce. All of the adults playing Pictionary or Trivial Pursuit at night. "Some pleasure," Suzanne grumbled, watching a 22-year-old child throw her life away. "Think of it this way. At least we'll get some nice family pictures," Ronnie said, as she triumphantly pulled the last bit of netting out of the drain. "Humph," said her sister, and changed the subject to a mole on her forearm with irregular edges and how her dermatologist was working through a post-quarantine backlog of patients and couldn't see her for months. Ronnie half paid attention, offering mmms and ohs, and that's too bad, as she emptied the dishwasher, still lost in a fantasy of the whole family together, eating steaks and fresh corn out on the deck, piling into the minivan for a trip to Long Nook Beach, where the kids would body surf and boogie board, swimming across the pond with her daughter and step-granddaughter alongside her. And Suzanne, she thought, frowning. Of course she'd have to invite Suzanne. Ronnie and Suzanne had never been close. These days, her sister called her once a week, mostly to complain about her children, her various health ailments, and all the problems she and her husband were having with the house that their parents had left to Suzanne and Veronica, a recitation that included lots of hinting that Veronica had gotten the better part of the bargain by allowing Suzanne to buy her out. Suzanne was just 3 years older than Ronnie, but in Ronnie's opinion, Suzanne and her husband Matt had gotten old a long time ago. They were always fretting about osteoporosis or a suspicious colonoscopy, forever sending her forwarded emails about how Barack Obama was actually a Muslim, or how COVID was a government-engineered virus, or telling her about the last seniors-only bus trip they'd taken in endless, excruciating detail. Lee used to call Suzanne and Matt doom and gloom. Ronnie smiled at that memory, as Suzanne launched into a story about a friend who'd been rear-ended in the parking lot of the Stop and Shop. "Was she hurt?" asked Ronnie. "No, but she could have been," Suzanne replied. She could almost see her husband rolling his eyes at her from across the room as Suzanne droned on. "What do you think they'll want for a wedding gift?" Suzanne asked. At some point, she must have brought the conversation back around to Ruby and Gabe. "Cash," said Ronnie. "Oh, but that's so impersonal. Ruby's still into drama, right?" "That was her major in college, and she's working in a theater, so I'm assuming the answer is yes." "Good, because I'm giving her a pair of Ma's earrings, and I bought her a coffee table book about Broadway musicals of the 1970s.
"If you already know what you're giving them, why did you ask?" Ronnie thought. "And then, you're buying a coffee table book for a couple whose apartment probably isn't big enough for a coffee table?" Although, of course, Suzanne and Matt wouldn't be buying, she imagined Lee saying. They'd be re-gifting. Ronnie kept her mouth shut, wiping down the kitchen counters and sweeping the floor, half listening while Suzanne blathered about the impossibility of shopping for her own grandchildren, two of whom evidently had asked for a birthday gift of a specific kind of sneaker that was both insanely expensive and impossible to find. "I sent Sam and Sarah those DNA kits for their birthday last week, so at least they're taken care of," Suzanne said. Ronnie felt her heart stop. She jerked her head up and lurched toward the phone. "What?" she asked. "Those 23andMe kits," Suzanne repeated. "Amazon had a sale on Prime Day, and I've been watching that show on PBS with that African-American professor where they get some famous person to come on and they analyze their DNA and tell them where they're from and if they're, like, related to any presidents or serial killers." The relish in her voice suggested that she much preferred it when the celebrities turned out to be related to criminals and not politicians. Ronnie's tongue felt like it had gotten very heavy, and her lungs felt like they couldn't expand to take in air. "Did you send the kits already?" she made herself ask. "Yes," said her sister, oblivious to Ronnie's distress. "Or I guess Jeff Bezos did. I emailed them and told them to send them back right away so we'll be able to discuss it when we're all together. That'll give us something interesting to talk about, right?" "Something interesting," Ronnie thought. Her blood was pounding in her ears, and she could taste old pennies under her tongue. Ronnie made some excuses and ended the call. She stood in her kitchen, the hand that held the phone pressed against her chest. For the first time since his death, she was glad that her husband wasn't there. glad that Lee hadn't lived long enough to see what might happen next. Rosa had been leaving her car after a shift at the hospital when the phone call came. "Mom? Mommy, it's me, Gabe." "Hello," she said, feeling her heart lift, as it always did, when she heard her son's voice, the way he'd always announce himself as if she didn't know who was calling. "I have news. Can you put me on FaceTime?" Heart pounding, already guessing at the news, Rosa fumbled with her phone until she'd hit the right button and her son's handsome, beloved face filled the screen. His girlfriend was there with him, and both of them were smiling. Rosa couldn't help but smile back as Gabe and Ruby told her that, indeed, they were going to be married in 3 months on Cape Cod over the 4th of July weekend. "I'm so happy for you," Rosa said over and over. "I'm thrilled," she'd said, "and Cape Cod, I've never been there, and Ruby, I can't wait to meet you in person." "Ruby, can you send me your parents' names and phone numbers? I'll need to get in touch with them." Both Gabe and Ruby assured her that they'd handle all the wedding planning, that it was going to be an intimate, casual affair, that Rosa didn't need to do a thing except make the trip and be their guest. But Rosa had insisted. "Please, I want to congratulate them," she'd said. Finally, the call was over. 30 seconds later, her phone dinged with a text. Sarah and Eli Danhauser, and an address in Brooklyn. Eli Danhauser. For a minute, Rosa sat frozen and motionless, her hands on the steering wheel, feeling shame pulse through her with each beat of her heart. Here was the retribution that she always knew was coming. Here were the consequences you could postpone but not avoid. Soon she'd be exposed as the worst kind of liar. And Gabe, her angel, the one person she'd managed to love successfully, the only relationship in her life she hadn't ruined, the one person she'd never betrayed, the one thing she'd done right in her life, Gabe would hate her too. Rosa Alvarez Andrews had grown up in Los Angeles. Her mother, Maria, had immigrated from Mexico, slipping over the border with two of her brothers and one of her sisters. The Alvarez siblings had picked strawberries and lettuce on the big farms in Ventura County. Eventually, her mother had fallen in love with and married Glenn Andrews, whose family owned one of those farms. Maria and Glenn had moved to a suburb of Los Angeles, where Glenn, who'd never much liked farming, had run a garage. And Maria had been an administrative assistant in the city school district. Glenn and Maria had 3 kids, Emmanuel, Rosa, and Amanda, the baby. And there was a path those children were meant to follow, a path that began with a high school diploma and continued on to college and white-collar, respectable employment, followed by marriage and families of their own. Manny, Rosa's big brother, got an engineering degree and made his parents proud. Mandy, Rose's little sister, was a professional party girl until she turned 21, settled down, and went to cosmetology school. Not ideal, but still okay, still a profession, especially since Mandy eventually ended up owning her own salon. Rosa, who'd never liked any of her classes besides art and music, who'd been the prettiest girl in her high school, the lead in every musical, had completed a single semester of community college at her parents' insistence. When she turned 19, she'd packed her belongings, mostly clothes and makeup, taken the money she'd saved, and gotten on a bus to New York City. Her parents wanted her to be a nurse or a dental technician or a paralegal. Rosa, with her long dark hair and big dark eyes, had other plans. She wanted to be a singer, a dancer, a star. Rosa found an apartment in Crown Heights that she shared with 3 roommates, and a job as a cocktail waitress at a nightclub in Manhattan. She could have made more money stripping or letting the customers at the nightclub take her home. Some girls did. Rosa didn't judge them, but she wasn't ready for that. At least, not yet. She signed up for dance and acting classes. She got a subscription to Backstage and started going out to every open audition and casting call for every show that she could find. It took Rosa maybe a month to realize that being the most talented girl in her high school did not make her even close to one of the best singers or dancers in New York. That having been prom queen wasn't enough to allow her to compete for the spots in the chorus line with girls who'd been models, or looked as if they could have been. She hung on for 2 years, slinging drinks, singing with a cover band that played Pat Benatar and Heart and Fleetwood Mac songs at the local bars, but only on Wednesday and Thursday nights. They never got quite good enough to headline on the weekends. She got called back twice, but ultimately wasn't cast as Mimi in the off-Broadway revival of Rent, and she'd played Fantine for 6 weeks doing Les Miserables at the Bucks County Playhouse. That was the extent of her theatrical success. Rosa kept trying, and while she was trying, she had sex. Lots and lots of sex. Being admired, being desired, being pursued all fed her self-esteem, which was being regularly decimated by the audition process. Her sense of herself as beautiful and talented and worthy was diminished every time she didn't get a role, every time a casting director hollered, "Next," without even looking at her face. Sex let her feel good about herself, even if only for a few hours, or in the case of her trysts with the cover band's bass player, Benji, a few minutes. Handsome men were, in her experience, the worst lovers, assuming that women were so thrilled to be in bed with them that they didn't have to make any effort to ensure their partner's pleasure. And gorgeous Benji, with his glossy black hair and pillowy lips, and the hollows under his cheekbones that made him look like a tubercular poet instead of a guy who hadn't picked up a book since high school, was no exception. When Rosa went to bed with a man, she could feel again like she was the most beautiful girl in her class, the most sought after and desired. And even though the feeling never lasted for long, it could give her enough of a boost to get her through another week of waitressing and auditions. She counted on the pill to keep her from getting pregnant, and the Planned Parenthood clinic to take care of any other unpleasant consequences of her adventures. By the time she was 21, Rosa had realized that she was never going to be J-Lo, or even a plain old working singer or actress with a spot in the chorus or the ensemble. She'd been to too many auditions with too many women who were prettier or more talented than she was. And now, even worse, she was beginning to see women younger than she was. Her options, as she saw them, were limited. She could keep trying and find a man to marry who'd support her while she did. She could keep trying on her own and resign herself to always having low-paying, exhausting day jobs. Or she could give up, go home, go back to school, and become the nurse or the paralegal her parents had always wanted. Then the world handed her option number 4, just after her 21st birthday. Rosa had gotten pregnant. She was almost positive that Benji, the bass player, was responsible. One of his friends had a place in the country, and Benji had invited Rosa to come with him for a weekend. They had stayed in a rambling, drafty old farmhouse, where almost all the bedrooms had fireplaces. It had been March, with gray skies and a raw, biting wind that made it unpleasant to be outside. Benji had built a fire in their bedroom, and they'd spent most of the next 3 days huddled under the covers doing everything they could to keep warm. 2 weeks later, she'd missed her period. Maybe, Rosa thought grimly, the amount of sex they'd had during that freezing weekend had overwhelmed the hormones in her bloodstream. When the pregnancy test she'd bought at the Dollar Tree came up positive, and then the name brand test for which she'd paid $15 at CVS gave her the same bad news, Rosa called in sick to work. She took a long shower, wrapped herself in her favorite robe, and sat on her bed. It was early in the afternoon on a Tuesday. The apartment was empty for once, all her roommates at work or at class or at auditions of their own. That rare solitude gave her an opportunity to think, but there was really no thinking to be done. Rosa was in no position to be a mother. With less than $200 to her name and an apartment she shared with three roommates, and Benji, even broker than she was in no position to help. Instead of calling Benji with the news, she called her sister. Amanda had always been a schemer, the cleverest of the siblings, the one who could usually talk her way out of trouble. Rosa knew Amanda would know what to do, and Amanda did not let her down. "Find some guy with a wedding ring who looks like he has money," Amanda said. "Screw his brains out. Don't give him your real name. Make sure you know where to find him and that he doesn't know where to find you. Wait 2 weeks and show up at his door. Tell him you're in trouble and that you don't want to keep it, and that you need money to take care of it. He'll be so terrified that you'll tell his wife he'll pay you, no problem." Rosa had considered asking how many times Amanda had used that particular scam herself, then decided that she didn't want to know. She'd followed her sister's instructions, and they had worked just like Amanda told her they would. With the money in hand, she'd scheduled the procedure back home in Los Angeles and bought the cheapest one-way ticket she could find. New York hadn't worked, but there was still L.A. She could get new headshots taken, find new acting classes, sign up with the agencies that cast extras, and start getting herself out there. But then, as the plane crossed over the Rockies, Rosa had a realization. "I am never going to be a singer," she thought. "I'm never going to be famous. I will never be a star. And a baby. A baby would be a companion. Someone who adored her and needed her and would never reject her and never leave." Rosa pictured a little girl with big dark eyes and soft dark curls, with Benji's beauty and Rosa's talent, a girl who would love her forever. By the time the pilot announced the start of their descent, Rosa's mind was made up. She'd had her big adventure, and now she would be a mother. And a good one. She put her hand on her still flat belly, her little question mark. "It's you and me, kiddo," she whispered. She was scared, but there was also, in the swirl of her fear and confusion, a thin, bright ribbon of hope. Rosa bounced a little bit as she made her way through the concourse, feeling the way she'd felt as a kid, picking up a wrapped gift from under the Christmas tree, wondering what was inside. Glenn and Maria did not welcome their prodigal daughter home with fatted calves and open arms. Instead, it was sour looks and "I told you so's" in two languages. Rosa's mother made it clear that she was not interested in being an abuela, that she'd done her time changing diapers and getting up in the middle of the night for midnight feedings. With her troublesome daughters finally out of the nest, Maria had retired, swapping the school district for the local casinos. She was happy spending her days at the San Manuel Indian Casino in front of the nickel slot machines. Glenn still worked full-time at the garage. Amanda was still in beauty school. And Manny had moved to Phoenix, where he'd found a job in a lab. Her parents allowed Rosa to move back to her old bedroom, with the stipulations that she do her own cooking and cleaning and laundry, and pay them $200 a month in rent. For the duration of her pregnancy, Rosa worked the kinds of jobs you could get with a high school diploma. She waitressed, she cleaned homes and office buildings, she worked as a cashier at a drugstore. At home, she took her high school posters off the wall and put up pictures of the alphabet and Mickey and Minnie Mouse. She replaced her vanity with a changing table and her desk with a second-hand crib. She bought a mobile that sent pink butterflies swirling to the tune of the Blue Danube Waltz when you wound it up. She filled her dresser with miniature pink and white onesies and socks no bigger than her thumb. She found a bugaboo stroller on Craigslist and rented a fancy breast pump from the hospital. She was ready for her princess to come home. Then Gabe had arrived, and Rosa, who'd been so convinced she was having a daughter that she hadn't asked for an ultrasound, had, for the first time in her life, fallen in love. From the minute she'd held her son, tracing his full cheeks, the snub of his nose, his bowed lips, touching the dark curls covering his head, she'd felt something inside of her shift. It was what you felt, she thought later, when you gave your heart away. The click you experienced when your focus changed completely. The moment she held her son in her arms was the moment she became an adult. Gabe was her angel, her darling, a sweet-natured, easy-going baby who was happy to be held, eager to nurse, and content when he dropped off to sleep, lying in his crib, staring at the glittery butterflies, or being pushed along the sidewalks in his pink stroller, which Rosa couldn't afford to replace. By the end of the first month of his life, he'd thawed his grandma's heart sufficiently that she was willing to give up 2 of her casino days to stay home and care for him. Rosa's dad was similarly enchanted. At night, he'd sit on the couch in front of the TV with the baby beside him, tucked under his arm, explaining the finer points of the professional wrestling match on the screen to his grandson, who'd sit content, gnawing at his fist and seeming to pay attention. Even Mandy was willing to give up a few hours of her busy social life to stay home with Gabe on a Saturday night. With that patchwork of family assistance in place, Rosa navigated Gabe's infancy and toddlerhood. She got a job at a steakhouse frequented by wealthy industry types who tip lavishly when you remembered their names and their drink orders. She told herself that she hadn't given up, that she'd start auditioning again someday. But someday never came, and Rosa was only occasionally regretful. How could she be sorry when she got to spend her days with her gorgeous, sweet, big-hearted boy? When he was 3, Rosa enrolled Gabe in preschool at a local synagogue, where Gabe learned his ABCs, his shapes, and his colors, along with, to Rosa's amusement, the Hebrew blessing for bread and wine and the prayers for Shabbat. Gabe had started talking late, but when he spoke, it was in complete and thoughtful sentences. By 4, he'd learned to read, and he read voraciously. Street signs, cereal boxes, movie posters, and any book Rosa would hand him. He had a lovely, clear singing voice, and with his huge brown eyes and glossy dark curls, he was so handsome that strangers would stop them on the street to ask if he'd ever modeled, or if he'd be interested in acting. Rosa would accept their praise and their business cards politely, then toss them as soon as she could. Having been through the scrutiny and rejection herself, the last thing she wanted to do was subject her son, her darling, to that kind of pain. As he got older, Gabe's essential nature never changed. If anything, with each year that passed, he became more kind and empathetic, more amiable and good-natured, as lovely on the inside as he was on the outside. "Mommy, how was your day?" he'd ask when he came home from school. He'd sit at the kitchen counter, and wondrously, he'd actually listen when she told him, which made him unlike the majority of the boys and men she'd ever known. By the time Gabe was in 4th grade, Rosa had enrolled in nursing school and had saved enough money to move them into a 1-bedroom apartment, an easy walk from her parents' house. Gabe had the bedroom, where there was a little bookshelf and space for his toys, and a desk where he could do his homework. Rosa slept on a pull-out couch in the living room. She didn't mind. She hadn't dated since her return from Los Angeles. She didn't mind that either, even though she could feel men's eyes on her, even though she'd been asked out by coworkers and bosses and Gabe's math teacher on parents' night at the school, by customers and fellow commuters and strangers on the street. She wasn't interested, nor did she feel lonely or deprived. Gabe was all she needed. Everything was for him. When Gabe had decided to go to college in New York City, Rosa had been quietly devastated. History was repeating itself. Now, instead of being the child who couldn't wait to fly away from the nest, she was the mother left behind. She told herself not to feel sad, that this was the way of the world. She would let her beloved only child go, and maybe someday he would find his way back to her. Only instead of Gabe's return, the pandemic had come, and he'd moved in with his girlfriend, Ruby Danhauser, whose last name should have sent alarms whooping in her brain instead of causing just a prickle of suspicion that Rosa had brushed aside. She should have paid more attention, but she hadn't, not even when she saw pictures of Ruby with her light eyes and her dark blonde curls, not even when she learned that Ruby's father was a dentist. None of it had registered until the day Gabe had called to tell her that they were getting married, and she'd finally, belatedly thought to ask for Ruby's father's first and last name. By the time the alarms were shrieking, the sirens were strobing, it was too late. Rosa had managed to drive herself home, back to the apartment in Silver Lake that she'd shared with her son. She went to Gabe's bedroom, where she sat on the edge of his bed. He'd left things neat when he'd gone off to college, an orderly row of books, Animal Farm, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Old Man and the Sea, was arranged on his desk. Pictures of friends and ticket stubs from concerts had been neatly thumbtacked to a corkboard on the wall. In a silver frame on top of his dresser was a photograph of his high school graduation. Gabe was smiling at the camera, and Rosa was smiling up at him. Potted plants lined his windowsill, an aloe vera sending spikes in every direction, a small prickly cactus, a houseplant he'd told her was called a mother-in-law's tongue. He'd made her promise to take care of them and had left a schedule telling her when each one needed to be watered, showing her how to test the soil. When he was little, she remembered, that was what he'd ask for. Not candy, not toys, but the cheap, half-dead plants from the clearance aisles in Home Depot. "Please, Mommy, it's only a dollar, and I know I can fix it," he'd say. "It just needs some love." Most of the time, he'd been able to bring those withered brown things back to life. "I don't deserve him," Rosa thought. For a long moment, she just sat, her hand on Gabe's pillow, her eyes on his picture, imagining she could still catch a ghost of his scent lingering in the room. She could feel the name that he'd texted her, the name of Ruby's father pulsing in her brain. "What are the chances?" she asked herself, shaking her head. Whatever those odds were, she'd beaten them. She'd gambled and she'd lost. And now, after all these years, the bill had finally come due. Sam. When his step-niece Ruby called to tell him she was engaged, Sam told her he was thrilled and meant it. He hadn't seen his mom or his sister and her family since before COVID. Now he had an occasion to visit. And of course, he had his own personal reasons for wanting to make a trip to Cape Cod. "It'll be a small wedding out on the deck," Ruby said. Sam told her that it sounded fantastic. He asked about the dates and dress code and promised to get Connor a suit and a tie, all the while thinking that the world or fate or God himself had sent him this opportunity, had placed it right in his lap. Now all he had to do was gather the scraps of his courage. He'd been standing on the very edge of the diving board for months. Ruby's wedding was the push he'd needed. Now maybe he could jump. Samuel Levy Weinberg had been born into a loving, upper-middle-class family with happily married parents and a twin sister who served as his guardian, clearing the way for him, speaking up for him, happily fighting his battles because Sarah loved a good fight. Sam had talked late because Sarah had talked early and in complete declarative sentences. And Sarah had spoken for both of them. No bath. Want cookie. On the playground, she'd walk fearlessly up to a new group of kids and announce herself and Sam to them. Hi, I'm Sarah Levy Weinberg, and this is my brother, Sam. We're twins. That was usually enough to start a conversation. Everyone had questions. Are you identical? Obviously not. Identical twins had to be the same gender. Besides, they didn't even look alike. Sam had his father's brown hair and changeable hazel eyes, while Sarah's hair was lighter and her eyes were a mixture of gray and blue. Did you have a secret language? Not exactly, but they'd always had a sense of what the other was feeling, a kind of twin telepathy informed by their shared history. If Sarah had gotten in a fight with her best friend, Sam would have sensed trouble, and he'd have known to get her a scoop of purple cow and a sugar cone and bring it to Gull Pond, where he'd find Sarah swimming. When Sam got cut from the baseball team, Sarah collected him in the car they shared, and they spent an hour or two driving on the highway, listening to the radio. When they were 18 and Sarah had given up on her piano soloist dreams and had gone to study music and English at Wellesley, Sam decided, in the way of thousands of young men before him, to head west. He'd enrolled at UC Berkeley, where he'd found, without his sister, that he'd felt unsurprisingly adrift. It didn't help that he kept getting dumped. Most of Sam's friends had gone through breakups where they'd been the ones to call it off, or where the end had been mutual. Sam, in spite of his best efforts, in spite of the romantic gestures that he made, in spite of being considerate and thoughtful and always remembering birthdays and anniversaries, was never the dump-er, always the dump-ee. Somewhere between the 3 and 6 month mark, when the first glow of infatuation was waning, first Tori, then Rebecca, then Celia had decided that she needed to be free. Tori, his senior year of high school girlfriend, had gotten interested in another guy, a college guy. And what could Sam do about that? But Rebecca had just shrugged when Sam asked her why she didn't want to be with him, looking as sad and as puzzled as Sam had felt. I don't know, she'd said. There's just something missing, something that isn't there. I can't say it better than that. Celia had been more explicit. I ask you what we should do on the weekend, and you say, whatever you want. I ask where you want to go to dinner, and you tell me I can pick. And then, when we get there, you don't even order for yourself. You just make me pick 2 things I want, and you order the one I don't get. Sam was bewildered. Isn't that a good thing? That way, you get 2 things you like. Celia had given an exasperated sigh. I want a guy who respects my opinions, sure, but I want him to have a few opinions of his own. After a 20-minute debriefing with his twin, I never liked her anyhow, Sarah told him. She had weird teeth. Sam sought the solace of his fraternity brother, Marcus. More specifically, the solace of Marcus's bong. Marcus lived on the fraternity's 3rd floor, in a room so cluttered with clothing and notebooks and classwork and pizza boxes and care packages from his well-meaning mom that it was impossible to see the floor. Sam had to carefully plot a course by identifying stable surfaces on which he could step. Gingerly, he made his way from a geology textbook to a pair of gym shorts to an open graphing notebook before finally reaching safe harbor on the bed. In spite of his slovenly habits and a room that looked like an ongoing audition for hoarders, Marcus managed to attract an astonishing variety of women with what looked to Sam like an almost magical ease. "You want to know the truth about women?" Marcus asked as he applied his lighter to the bottom of the bong. "They call themselves feminists. They think they want to be in charge, but do you know what they really want?" "No," Sam said. "Clearly, I do not." With his free hand, Marcus thumped his chest and gave a Tarzan-like yodel.
They want a caveman.
Sam frowned. His father was not a caveman, and his dad had been married to his mom, happily, as far as Sam knew, for almost 23 years. Sarah, his sister, did not seem drawn to chest thumpers.
They might not say that's what they want, Marcus clarified.
He hit the bong, held his breath, and let it out in a series of coughs that made the air even thicker with resinous smoke.
They might not even really know that's what they want, but women like decisiveness, strength.
So they want to be bossed around? This was sounding disturbingly like some of what Sam had read in the men's rights subreddits, where every man was owed sex and where women were targets, or Bettys, or bitches, or worse.
Some women like that, I guess, Marcus said.
He scratched at the scruff on his cheeks.
But most of them just want someone who knows what he likes, and knows what he wants, and knows that he wants her. And a woman wants to feel like you went out there and fought to get her.
Sam must have looked confused because Marcus got up, dislodging several textbooks, an iPod, and half a basket of laundry, and crossed the room to pat Sam's shoulder.
Just watch me tonight.
A few hours later, Sam and Marcus stood in the fraternity's living room, each holding a beer. Sam had shaved and changed his shirt. Marcus had done neither of those things. The scent of pot still clung to his clothing. His eyes were red-rimmed, but still sharp as he scanned the crowd.
Pick a girl, Marcus said.
Sam considered his choices, finally nodding at a girl with a dark brown ponytail and glasses and a denim dress and sneakers.
Target acquired, Marcus murmured,
and headed out to the dance floor, with Sam a few steps behind him.
Hey there, he said with a smile when he reached the girl. Those are great glasses.
The girl touched the frames, looking puzzled and, Sam could see it already, charmed.
Thank you.
I think I might need glasses, Marcus said.
You should get your eyes checked, the girl replied.
If I do that, will you help me pick out a pair? Like, where'd you get those?
The girl told him the name of the store. Then she told Marcus the name of her ophthalmologist, and how long she'd been wearing glasses, and how it felt when she got her first pair and discovered that the green blur above every tree trunk was comprised of individual leaves. Marcus listened attentively, touching the girl's arm, then her shoulder, finally playfully tweaking her ponytail. A few minutes later, they were on the dance floor, the girl's arms draped over Marcus's shoulders, and her glasses perched on his face. Sam attempted to put Marcus's lessons into action when he spotted Gracie Chen Cohen around the campus. Gracie had a notched eyebrow and a pierced belly button and a tattoo of a koi fish, brilliantly orange and green and gold, spiraling down the length of her left hip and thigh. Sam had noticed the tattoo when he'd seen Gracie striding through the quad in a pair of cut-off denim shorts. Remembering Marcus, Sam had approached her the next time he saw her.
Hey, he'd said, that's a great tattoo.
Isn't it? Gracie had said with a grin.
I'm thinking about getting a tattoo, Sam lied. I don't have any yet.
Oh, yeah? She didn't seem too interested, but Sam was undeterred.
Where's the best place for a tattoo virgin?
When Gracie told him, Sam asked, if I decide to do it, can you come help me pick one out? She'd agreed.
Told you so, said Marcus, when Sam gave him the news.
That weekend, Sam had gotten a tiny infinity symbol inked on the inside of the second toe of his right foot, and a date for Friday night. He and Gracie had been a couple for 6 ecstatically happy months. Gracie had been the most sexually confident woman he'd ever been with. She had a vibrator, insisted on equal opportunity orgasms, and was happy to show Sam how to help her have them. Sam and Gracie had sex in a bar's bathroom. In her off-campus apartment, he'd gone down on her until she'd almost writhed off the bed in delight, and then she'd hopped back onto it to return the favor. Sam was blissfully content, and imagined that Gracie was too. But then, precisely at the 6-month mark, Gracie had dumped him. She'd done it kindly. She'd sworn it wasn't him, it was her. She'd told him that his person was out there, but that she wasn't it. 2 weeks later, she'd started dating a woman named Elise. "So you're gay?" Sam asked when he'd gotten Gracie to agree to meet him for coffee. "You like women now?" It was, he thought glumly, the logical next step in the progression. First women would stop liking him, then they'd stop liking men completely. "I don't know about women," she said, and smiled a dreamy smile, "but I definitely like Elise." Sam glared at her. Gracie's smile disappeared. "Sorry," she murmured. "So you're bi?" "I'm Gracie," she replied with a shrug. "Just Gracie. And I know who I am." She put one of her small, capable hands on top of Sam's. "Do you?" "Of course." She kept looking at him, her gaze unyielding. "Yeah, but do you really?" "Yes," he'd said, his voice rising. "Yes, I do." Gracie had followed him home to pick up the last of her things. Not 5 minutes after she'd collected her toiletries from Sam's bathroom and retrieved her vibrator from under his bed, the phone rang. Sam knew immediately who was calling. "Hey." "What happened?" Sarah could always tell when something had gone wrong for him. Sam didn't always know when something was upsetting Sarah, but more than half the time he would feel something, a pain behind his eyes, a twinge in his side. Usually Sarah could feel his tug at the other end of the rope that would always connect them. "Gracie and I broke up." "Oh, Sam." Sarah sounded sympathetic, but he noted, not especially surprised. "She says I don't know who I am." Instead of saying, "That's bullshit," or, "Of course you know who you are," his sister said nothing. "What?" Sam asked. When she didn't answer, he asked again, more loudly. "What?" "Well," he could tell Sarah was being careful, taking time to choose her words. "It's just that you can be a bit of a chameleon." Sam frowned. "What do you mean?" "Okay, remember in middle school when you started playing hockey and you were like Mr. Hockey, all the time?" "I liked hockey," Sam protested. "And then senior year of high school, you started dating Tori, who thought that contact sports reenacted the toxic gender dynamics of the patriarchy?" Sam was impressed that Sarah remembered verbatim exactly what his girlfriend had said when she'd held forth that Thanksgiving dinner at the Levy Weinberg house. "So you stopped playing hockey, and you joined that a cappella group." "I like singing." Sarah's voice was infinitely patient. "I'm not saying you don't. You have a very nice voice." She hummed a few bars of My Coney Island Baby. Sam ignored her. "What else?" he asked. "Then when you and Tori broke up," Sam mentally thanked his sister for not saying, "Then Tori dumped you. And by the way, remind me why you decided to go to Berkeley?" Sam pressed his lips together, remembering Tori lecturing him. "You need to figure out who you are as a person, not as a twin." It was Tori who'd urged him to look at schools in California, luring him with pictures of sand and sun and surfing, and of course with the fact that she was going to Stanford. Then Tori had dumped him, and Sam had been stranded, single, and 3,000 miles away from home. "Then you get to college, and you start dating Celia, and you join a fraternity." "I wanted to make friends." Sam realized he was almost shouting. He lowered his voice. "Berkeley is a very big school. A fraternity helped to make it feel more manageable." "Of course. I felt like I had a community." "Makes sense. And Phi Kappa Psi wasn't, you know, one of the toxic fraternities." "Yeah," Sarah said dryly. I'm sure women are treated with consideration and respect, and the brothers are all very big on consent. Sam closed his eyes. So then you're Mr. Greek Life, until you and Celia break up and you drop out of the fraternity.
It was costing a fortune, and I got busy with my thesis. I was never there, and it didn't make sense to.
And you start dating Gracie. Sam squeezed his eyes more tightly shut. And Gracie's an artist, so you move in with her into that, Sarah paused, place, that commune or whatever it is. It's a co-op, Sam said wearily, a vegan co-op. It was actually, per its charter, a long-running experiment in meat-free, mutually respectful communal living, one of Berkeley's longest-running off-campus houses, with generations of pot smoke and patchouli fumes contained within its plastered walls.
And you start doing morning pages, and you grow out your hair, and you get a tattoo.
Sarah was the only one in the world, aside from Gracie, who knew about his tattoo. Sam hoped she hadn't told their parents, who would undoubtedly freak out.
I know you better than anyone in the world, Sarah said. And I feel like there's this piece of you that maybe you're not entirely sure about yet.
So I'm missing pieces. Sam could hear the bitterness in his voice. But why shouldn't he be bitter? No one else he knew was missing anything. They'd all found their place. They all had their thing. His father had known, since reading To Kill a Mockingbird in sixth grade, that he'd wanted to be a lawyer. His mom had known even sooner than that, that her life would involve reading and writing. Sarah, of course, had been a pianist, a serious musician who'd never wavered from her path until she'd segued, painlessly as far as Sam could tell, to music education. Gracie would surely end up being some kind of artist, but even if she didn't, she'd always have her style, her tattoos, her piercings, her sense of who she was. Sam had never felt that kind of pull toward an activity or a hobby or a profession. He'd liked hockey well enough, but it hadn't hurt him to drop it. Same with a cappella and the fraternity. And he could already tell that he wasn't going to miss morning pages, even though he'd enjoyed sitting with Gracie every day, scribbling intently in purple ink. He certainly wasn't going to miss his mom sniffing as she announced that journal was not a verb.
Maybe I'm wrong, Sarah said, hearing condemnation in Sam's silence. But Mom did always say you were a late bloomer.
She said that? Sam felt angry. More than that, he felt tired. Sarah's voice was small.
Oops.
Then she said, look, you'll figure it out. There's no rush. If you are missing something, and I'm not saying you are, you've got plenty of time to find it. Sam would have many occasions to revisit Gracie's assessment, and Sarah's and his mom's as the years went on, as he graduated from college and followed Marcus to L.A.
Where the grass is green and the girls are pretty, Marcus had crowed.
Marcus wanted to be an agent and got a job as an assistant in one of the big talent agencies, while Sam, who'd studied coding, found a niche in the legal world, in internet security, search engine optimization, and reputation management. He helped law firms establish their online profiles, ensuring their names came up first in the searches that people conducted, that the articles and links the firms wanted highlighted appeared near the top of the queue, and that anything less positive or flattering got pushed toward the bottom. He could have done his work anywhere, but he figured that Hollywood was the land of reinvention, a place where people changed their faces, their names, their bodies, their entire identities. If Sam was going to figure out who he was, there were worse places to do it. He and Marcus were roommates for the first few years. Then Marcus had gotten engaged and moved out, and Sam had kept the two-bedroom apartment in Los Feliz, turning the second bedroom into a home office. He thought that he'd miss the seasons, the fall foliage, the first snow in the winter, but he quickly got used to the temperate weather, the sunny days and cool nights, and found that he didn't miss the blizzards that turned the roads into impassable, ice-rutted obstacle courses, or the bleak gray days of late winter, or the August humidity. He worked, he took up hiking, and joined a tennis club, where he played tennis 2 mornings a week. He saw friends from college, and the few new ones he'd made at the office. He kept in touch with Gracie, who was living in Seattle as part of a throuple, managing a clothing boutique. Every few months, she'd find a cheap flight to L.A. She'd sleep in the second bedroom and cajole Sam into taking her on the star tours or to Universal Studios or to Malibu, where they'd drive along the twisting roads and Gracie would insist that every middle-aged man they saw was Kelsey Grammer. Sam had no trouble meeting women, at work, at the tennis club, in line for the movies. He had a number of relationships, even though none of the women he dated had ever set him